supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Lawmakers in our region are weighing into the debate over what to do in Syria. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. While Congress is usually marred by partisan gridlock, the question of whether to follow last night's airstrikes with further military force divides members of the same party. More from WHYY Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo.
Many lawmakers are surprised by how quickly President Trump changed his approach to Syria. Just last week, his administration signaled that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was there to stay, which critics say emboldened him to use the chemical weapons against his people. But by the end of the week, the president launched a bombing campaign that Democratic Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania says was long overdue.
I've said for years that we should have hit his airfields.
Casey opposes sending ground troops into Syria. He's calling on President Trump to keep pressing for removing Bashar al-Assad and to lay out a clear strategy in the region. But Casey says last night's airstrikes were justified.
The idea that we can just condemn it and move on is just totally unacceptable. So it's been a source of frustration for me for years, literally.
Other Democrats say they're worried that the president launched an airstrike without asking permission from Congress. Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey says he's got lots of questions.
I want to understand the justification for the strike. Clearly there are rules in terms of the president's ability to use military force, and so I have a lot of concerns.
Fellow Democratic Senator Chris Coons from Delaware says the strategy in the region needs to be much broader than just a military solution.
I expect the Trump administration to consult with Congress and Congress to do its job to help develop a strong and positive strategy for how to engage in Syria, both against ISIS and Assad, and to ask and push probing questions forward for the administration about how long, how will we pay for it, and how will we resolve it.
New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez is sponsoring legislation to put more sanctions against top Russian officials who are helping prop up the Syrian leader.
You need to change the dynamics. Pendulum has swung to Assad because of Russia and Iran. Unless you hold them accountable as well, change the dynamics, you're not going to get a political solution.
Syria has been locked in a nasty civil war for the past few years, which Philadelphia Democratic Congressman Brendan Boyle says is unacceptable.
This has probably been the biggest black eye in U.S. foreign policy over the last 5 years. The situation is enormously complex.
Boyle says this week's gas attack was a game changer.
The vivid, disgusting images of children gasping for the last breaths brought me to tears. I think it moves most, if not all, people. It's a vivid sign of the brutality of the Assad regime and also its backer in Vladimir Putin and the Russian regime.
Boyle is also calling for more sanctions against Russian and Syrian officials.
I've been concerned that this administration would come in and roll back the existing sanctions. I'm hoping that the apparent reversal of President Trump on the way he views the Syria situation, I hope that he's also reversing himself on how he views Vladimir Putin as well.
Republican Congressman Tom MacArthur from South Jersey is also calling on the Trump administration to use smart diplomacy to ratchet up pressure on Assad from all sides.
Syria's allies, Iran and Russia, bear some responsibility for this. And as we have, as has been clearly demonstrated over the last 8 years, 9 years, we cannot just march in and fix what's going wrong in Syria.
Congress is now in recess for 2 weeks. But if the fighting escalates, some lawmakers say they should cancel their break and come back to debate how to respond to the conflict. For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Philly 311, the city's non-emergency contact center, has for the past year been headed by Executive Director Tim Thornton, who brings with him ideas formed from decades working in the private business sector. All this week, NewsWorks Tonight listeners were offered a chance to call in questions for Tim, and earlier today, we presented some of them to him during a visit to 311 headquarters at City Hall.
Why don't we start at the beginning? Philly 311 was established in 2008. What was its mission then, and how has it evolved?
I had to actually do some research because, you know, I've been in here a year. So I was on looking at the internet and reading actually the bill that introduced it. And the father of Philly 311 is Jim Kenney, which is great, our existing mayor. So you can tell he's got a little skin in the game. He wants it to be successful. And he wrote that there was four reasons to do it. The one was that there'd been so much success in other cities. So there was quite a few, hey, Baltimore's done awesome, New York's done great with this. So there had been a proven track record. The second thing was that it seemed really confusing. You know, you think about it and all the different agencies, and you basically had to call 215-686-1776 or find your council person to get a question to almost anything, potholes or whatever. The third thing was that maybe there'd be some data to look for trends and things to see if you could make things better in the city. And the last was this accountability point, that if you had a 311 service, there could be data that would talk about how the city's doing and make government services more accountable.
Now, you use the term accountable, and I understand you've pioneered the use of the term customer service.
Well, in the city, we'd like to say that we focus insanely on customer service. You know, Zappos sort of made it famous, right, that they don't sell shoes, they sell customer service. And we really want to be that way in the city. You know, in fact, we actually have a recent campaign. If your mom was on the phone, are you proud of this call? Because, you know, there's an easy way to answer a call, and then there's a way to actually ask a few additional questions and really get at the spirit of what's trying to go on. So we want to have mom-like service.
Now, you know, all week we've invited NewsWorks Tonight listeners to call in anticipation of our conversation. Here's one that specifically speaks to that call.
Hi, this is Bernie in Kensington, and I'd like to ask Philly's 311 director why the 311 mobile app requires users to allow the city of Philadelphia to access all users' phone book contacts, pictures, and all other documents stored on their cell phone. And why the city of Philadelphia has failed to publish a privacy policy explaining what it can do with all that personal data it has access to.
Tim, the caller is bringing up legitimate privacy issues. Is our information vulnerable in that regard?
What those messages are the default message when we go after the picture. So the only thing, when you use the mobile app, the only thing we're really using is the picture. I think the caller addresses a concern that we need to look at, because it's an unintended consequence to say that we're going after that privacy. In fact, the Philly 311 data is an open data set and is available to everyone. So we really make sure, want to scrub names out of that. So if you go to the data set, you'll see the data, actually, we've removed the names from it.
Tell us a little bit about the nuts and bolts of the center. How many customer service agents do you have? How long is the shift? What are the quantity of calls you receive?
We take about 650,000 questions, connections, service requests in a year. If you look at that 650,000, about 30% of them are service requests.
So
pothole
car
is
removal.
A good one. Actually, Philly's most favorite one is abandoned cars. We will take several thousand abandoned car complaints in a year.
You take in calls from residents, and we've spoken inordinately about that, but also businesses and visitors. Let's talk a little bit about those categories.
Well, we get a lot of calls from businesses about license and inspection issues. So we take a majority of those phone calls for them and try to get you through. And if you have a technical issue that we can't solve, then we move you on to license and inspections. We don't get as many questions from visitors. We get a lot of walk-in folks from visitors. We'd like to have more. If you look at our data, 80% of our calls are repeat callers. You know, 20% of our callers are new. So what we want is more new callers.
Instead of the same smaller cadre of people calling and
right.
calling and calling. I mean, not that their issues aren't legitimate.
No. I mean, we clearly, 5% of our callers create 20% of our volume. So when you think about that, they're believers, right? They might be slightly unhappy with us believers at times, but they're believers. What we want is that new user to call in and then become a repeat user.
Do you have the opportunity when you're puzzled in terms of how to proceed to call up your analog in Baltimore or New York or another similar size city and see how they're going about it?
Yeah, there's actually...
And is that useful?
Yeah, it's absolutely useful. And there's actually a users group that we can go to that I haven't been yet, but I know some of my teams. But we've been to New York. been to Baltimore, and we have really learned a lot. I mean, and especially New York is one of those things where their budget's bigger than ours, and they've made a lot of technology investments, and they tell us what works and doesn't work, which is really cool, so we don't have to make those mistakes.
Tim Thornton, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
That's Tim Thornton, Executive Director of Philly 311. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Now, the song you're hearing is a live, improvised ode to Philly 311 by Philadelphia musician Ken Queter. If you were listening to WHYY's Morning Edition today, you may have heard arts and culture reporter Peter Crimmins' story about a new exhibition and theatrical performance at the Free Library of Philadelphia called We the Detectives. That story ended with a mystery. Peter picked up on a trail of crumbs that led him to the very origins of detective stories at the Rosenbach Museum.
The Free Library houses a great number of mysteries and treasures in its building on the parkway. For example, Charles Dickens' pet raven named Grip. The taxidermy bird is now forever gripping a branch behind glass, and it lives at the library. Grip may have been the inspiration of Edgar Allan Poe's celebrated poem, The Raven. That raven now appears in a walking play called Gumshoe, where audience members are led on a dizzying route through the library to solve the mystery of Edgar Allan Poe.
Hi. Hi. Gather in closely, guys. Thank you.
This is Jensen Titus Lavallee. He's an actor with the theater company New Paradise Laboratories. He's playing the part of a secret agent, and here he's at a glass display case covered in a gold shroud.
This is why you guys are here, okay? This is the mystery that we brought you in for, so you guys are the first people we've been allowed to share this with.
Lavallee pulls away the shroud, unveiling a document, purportedly in the hand of Edgar Allan Poe. It's a kind of dream map, a drawing outlining the plot of his short story, Murders in the Rue Morgue. Lavallee explains that this document was only recently discovered underneath the floorboards of the historic Poe House in Northern Liberties while that building was undergoing renovations last summer.
So the mystery, the question, is why would Poe have wanted to hide these under the floorboards? We don't know.
Wait, hold on. I have to stop him there because I'm an arts reporter in Philadelphia, and a newly unearthed Poe document seems like something I would have heard of before. So the question really is, why would the library want me to look at a fabricated document when the original manuscript for that same Poe story, actually written in Poe's hand, is just a few feet away in an exhibition called We the Detectives?
Somebody reached him before we did and murdered him.
Using radio plays, movie posters, television clips, Nancy Drew paperbacks, even Scooby-Doo toys, curator Karen Sooney traces the evolution of detective fiction from Poe's character, Auguste Dupin, to Benedict Cumberbatch in PBS's Sherlock.
I really wanted something that highlighted this very popular nature of this genre, and by the fact that it goes into stage plays, radio, you know, television, movies, and the fact that we have the Murders in the Rue Morgue manuscript here in the Rare Book Department is kind of help to kick the whole thing off.
The Edgar Allan Poe story, Murders in the Rue Morgue, is often considered the first detective story, but is it? And why did the library hire a theater company to try to pass off a fake Poe document? The answers are not here. They're at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Rittenhouse Square. It has a companion exhibition called Clever Criminals and Daring Detectives. It's sort of a prequel to Murders in the Rue Morgue. Judy Gustin, the director of collections, says before Poe, most crime writing was true crime, bloody stories told in hysterical language.
I hear a most shocking murder reported in the most grisly way. You know, the diabolical deed was perpetrated, blah, blah, blah. You know, and so it's very colorful language.
Gustin's collection goes back to the 17th century when writers were not inventing stories about crime, but rather they were amping up criminal drama.
Cupid, the barge robber, One-Eyed Thompson, the anti-heroes, right? Billy Fish, the dandy pickpocket, sets them up to be, in the future, the population of drama.
This exhibition suggests that writers did not just invent fictional detectives, they invented real detectives. In the early 18th century, writers like Daniel Defoe were making pamphlets advocating for a community-based police force with the ability to investigate crime. He's talking about detectives, something that had not existed before.
When we see writers suggesting that that's how things should be organized, maybe we should get some people together and have a police force, that's exactly how this happens, that it's a suggestion of people who are writing about crime rather than something that's happening organically out of government.
In the center of this exhibition is a leather box secured with a combination padlock. Using that fabricated map from the Free Library and clues gleaned from this room, you should be able to figure out how to open the lock.
Huh. And then you find this, and then you find you're not there yet.
Using the clues in the box, the hunt for truth takes you back out on the streets of Philadelphia, where the mystery continues. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
President Donald Trump has made several new policy proposals. Some have taken effect, some are in legal limbo, others have yet to be effectuated. Let's see where the public stands on the roster with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
So did you run each of some 15 proposals past respondents?
We did exactly that. We asked for each one, do you agree with this, do you disagree with it, or do you not know enough to say? And we end up with a very interesting rank order of what Americans taken as a whole want the president to do out of all the things that he has talked about. And two of these come to the top. The government requiring companies to allow employees who have children to have a family leave. He proposed that in his State of the Union address in January, his address to Congress. Hadn't done much about it since then, but certainly he proposed that. Americans love the idea, Democrats and Republicans all together. That's the number one thing he can do. Number two, $1 trillion for infrastructure. This is clearly approved of by both Democrats and Republicans. Overwhelmingly, they say yes. And you know, Trump's reading the data. He did an interview with the New York Times this week, and he said to the reporters interviewing him, you know, infrastructure is very popular with the American public. So he said he would go on and try to tie that in with tax reform or a new health care plan, because he knew infrastructure is the one thing that you've got many, many Americans supporting.
Well, if he's reading the numbers, clearly, most people were not on board with the replacement plan offered by Republicans to the Affordable Care Act.
That's right. And of course, the plan bombed. They couldn't bring it to a vote in the House. Our data, and we've looked at this very carefully because it's complex, clearly show one thing, Dave, above all else, that Americans do support the idea of tweaks to the Affordable Care Act. Now, if you give them three choices, that is, the public three choices, one of which is to keep it and don't touch it, one of which is to keep the ACA but make significant changes to it, and the other is to R&R, that is, repeal and replace it, you have just 30% who will choose that last option, with almost half saying keep it but make tweaks to it, and a smaller number saying keep it and don't touch it.
Frank, if you're using the term tweaking, that implies that perhaps more Americans like the Affordable Care Act than perhaps they even did under President Obama's tenure.
They do. We just updated our question that we've been asking for a number of years now about basic support for the Affordable Care Act. We're up to 55%. That's the highest that we've seen, clear majority support for the Affordable Care Act in our polling. It had been supported, been even, you know, break even with support and lack of support down to the 40% range, but a clear bump up. A lot of Democrats now are saying yes, and some independents are more likely to say yes. As a result of all this discussion of the Affordable Care Act, I guess the bottom line is, it's not looking so bad to a number of Americans who previously said they didn't support it.
Family leave, infrastructure, health care. What else was on the list?
Building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico gets less support than any of the other 15 proposals that we looked at. A clear message from the American public is put your emphasis on other things, not on building a wall.
Frank, not much surprise that folks who gather around the water cooler at WHYY and presumably Gallup are inordinately talking about politics. It's part and parcel of what we do here. But in general, in the American workplace, are employees talking a lot about politics now?
They are. We just asked workers nationwide, is there more discussion of politics over the last 4 months at your place of employment than there was previously? And almost 6 out of 10 say yes. We then followed up and say, well, is this a good thing or a bad thing? And the majority of Americans said, workers said it didn't matter. But we had about 20% of workers who said it was a negative, having a negative effect at their place of employment. And that's more than said it was having a positive effect. And when we probed those people who said this discussion of politics was negative, They talked about a lot of different things, but it included this idea of clashes between different groups of political opponents who are now fighting with each other in the workplace instead of getting along as they should be.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader, with assistance from Robin Bloom. At the helm this week, Diana Martinez and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations, and our News Director is Eugene Son. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.